Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. The White House has changed course on briefing Congress about domestic surveillance, and we'll have more on that in a moment. But first, in a speech to members of the National Guard today, President Bush provided more details about how investigators foiled a terrorist plot in the weeks following the 9/11 attacks to fly a commercial jet into the tallest building on the West Coast in Los Angeles.
Rather than use Arab hijackers as he had on September the 11th, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed sought out young men from Southeast Asia, whom he believed would not arouse as much suspicion. To help carry out this plan, he tapped a terrorist named Hambali, one of the leaders of an al-Qaeda-affiliated group in Southeast Asia called J.I.
Joining us now from Washington is Jonathan Landay, Senior National Security and Intelligence Correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What are the new details from the president today about this terrorist plot in Los Angeles?
Yeah, this was one of 10 terrorist plots that the president has previously spoken about as being foiled as a result of cooperation between the United States and various other intelligence agencies. What we now understand to be new is are the details. The involvement of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Hambali, what was purportedly to be the use of shoe bombs to gain access to the cockpit of a plane that was, according to the president, to be flown into the Liberty Tower in Los Angeles. That last part being not so such a new detail.
Mm-hmm. Remind us again, Hambali and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who are they?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the operational chief behind the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He was, in fact, involved in a number of terrorist attacks and or plots, I should say, before that, before joining up with al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. He had been involved with his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, in plotting various other terrorist attacks that didn't come off, and he's been linked to attacks that, in fact, did come off, including the nightclub bombings in Bali, Indonesia. Hambali was a chief operative of Jamaat Islamiyah. It is a Islamic militant group based in that operates in Southeast Asia, wedded to creating an Islamic state in all of the Muslim parts of Southeast Asia. He is an Indonesian, and Jamaat Islamiyah is believed to be based in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. And he was captured.
Yes, Hambali was captured, and apparently, according to the president, as a result of cooperation between the United States and other and nations in Southeast Asia, and apparently it seems that he also appears to have provided some of the information that was put together in terms of the background of this plot.
Mm-hmm. And this recruitment of young men from Southeast Asia, was this as serious an issue before as it probably will be now after the president's speech today?
It has been, yes. I mean, there have been numerous Islamic militants from Southeast Asia who went through the al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan and have been involved in waging jihad. There is an ongoing Muslim insurgency in the Philippines and in Thailand, the one in Thailand becoming especially critical in southern Thailand.
You mentioned that the president has mentioned these plots before, but today we got more details. Why are we getting the details now?
There were a lot of questions asked about the last time he raised these plots, disclosed these 10 plots, and there weren't a lot of details forthcoming the last time he mentioned these, and therefore I guess the White House felt it incumbent to try and provide some details on one of these plots. And let's not forget, this comes amid the wider context of the controversy over the National Security Agency's domestic wire eavesdropping operation and the fact that the administration has declined to provide details details of that, saying that they're secret and they need to continue running this operation. So it may be an attempt by the administration to at least provide some clarity on issues related to terrorism that may not be it may not have problem releasing now in order to, you know, previously they claimed that they need to safeguard methods and means by which intelligence is collected. Perhaps it's gotten to the point now where they feel that they can talk about this particular operation.
But he said multinational cooperation foiled the Los Angeles attack, at least, and he didn't mention the National Surveillance Program.
No, he didn't, which was curious because this was the right crowd to do it in, is the National Guard Association, a military setting, and he did not feel that he needed to, I guess, mention this program that's been under considerable criticism, not just from Democrats, but from growing numbers of Republicans, and perhaps that's why he decided that he wasn't going to mention this program, because it is as controversial as it is.
Mm-hmm. So then these wiretaps didn't necessarily mean these plots were foiled.
My understanding is that at least in this particular case, there was no connection between the NSA eavesdropping program and this particular and the busting of this particular case. This was more reliant on intelligence gleaned and captures made by the intelligence services, the security services of countries in Southeast Asia.
All right. Well, Jonathan, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Landay is Senior National Security and Intelligence Correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Well, when the president spoke earlier today, he did not, as we said, mention his controversial domestic surveillance program, and Congress continues to question that program, and the White House has backed down from its initial refusal to provide additional information about it. Yesterday, the White House held a closed-door meeting with the House Intelligence Committee, and that meeting came after the committee chair, Republican Congresswoman Heather Wilson, broke ranks with the administration and called for a full congressional inquiry. Wilson is a former Air Force officer, the only female veteran in Congress, and she was an aide to the National Security Council under the first President Bush. We spoke with Congresswoman Wilson on a noisy cell phone earlier today, and we asked if she was satisfied with yesterday's meeting with White House officials.
Yesterday's meeting was a good first step. We still have other questions that we're going to have to get answered, but I think that the Intelligence Committee in the House and in the Senate is the place where we need to understand exactly what this program does and how it does it. And there are checks and balances in our Constitution, and we need to make sure that we do our jobs.
Who briefed the committee for the White House?
Yesterday, it was the Deputy Director for National Intelligence, Mike Hayden, who is formerly the head of the National Security Agency, and the Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm. Were all members of your committee there?
Not everyone was there, but it was very well attended on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. The information provided, it's my understanding it was classified information, involved some operational details of the program. Was that enough, do you think, to at least make this first step?
It was the first meeting. It was about 3.5 hours long, and the administration decided to give us more operational information and information on how they go about doing this work and exactly what they're doing and why. There's more information we're going to need without question, but it was a good first step.
Mm-hmm. What questions do you think are now still unanswered?
There's a wide variety of them. I think every individual members have their own sets of questions. But I think what we're trying to do is to understand exactly what the program is and does, what are the limitations on it, what are the ways that civil liberties are protected, and that's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Is the FISA court role in all of this part of your inquiry as well?
Yes, the Intelligence Committee has oversight of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and how it operates, as well as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that is the secret court that reviews these proposed warrants.
Mm-hmm. And so that's another issue that you want addressed from the Bush administration to your committee and to lawmakers in general?
Well, part of this issue is, how does FISA work, and are there problems with the way that FISA works or doesn't work sometimes? So we'll be looking at that as well.
Mm-hmm. What are some of those problems?
The Attorney General has testified in open session and talked publicly about difficulty, the need for timeliness, and that it, that and putting together information for a FISA application is lengthy. We're going to take a look at that and see whether it is lengthy or not, and whether the FISA Act needs to be updated to take into account 21st century communications. This is a law that was written in 1978. While it's been updated in some respects, you know, 1978, phones still hung on the walls. The word internet wasn't in the dictionary. We want to take a look at what, if anything, needs to be changed in the FISA Act.
Are you still calling for a congressional inquiry?
The congressional inquiry began yesterday.
So this is one part of the whole process of what you have referred to as a painstaking congressional inquiry.
Oversight is a very detailed process in my mind, and it is painstaking, but it requires information from the executive branch. We have two branches of government involved in this. One, that we check and balance each other, but it requires information from the administration, from the NSA, from the Attorney General, and from the Director of National Intelligence for us to do our jobs. What I insisted on and what started yesterday was that they would give us the information to be able to do our job, and we'll oversee this program.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this program helps Americans be safer?
We haven't gotten into all of the results of the program, and I think people still have questions there. But from my initial look at this, is that it may make a significant contribution to America's security.
If it's done differently or as it's done now?
We're still asking some questions about exactly how it's done, and I haven't gotten the answers to all those questions. And I prefer to start out from the facts, understanding exactly what they're doing, how they're doing it, and what the results are.
Congresswoman Heather Wilson, chair of the House Intelligence Subcommittee that's responsible for overseeing the National Security Agency. She's a Republican from New Mexico. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. And just ahead, a scholar and author argues that the president's secret spying program does not make Americans safer. And he says some Western ideas about terrorism and terrorists are all wrong. And later in the show, the governor of Montana has a plan that he says will make the U.S. less dependent on foreign oil. There's more coming up here and now. Here and now. As we mentioned, President Bush pointed today to a foiled terrorist plot against the United States as a sign that the war against terrorism is successful. But our next guest argues that the United States needs a more sophisticated approach to fighting that war and should have a broader understanding of the roots of terrorism in the Islamic world. Hussein Haqqani is director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. Professor Haqqani, you wrote an article in the journal Foreign Policy about what you say are misconceptions about terrorism, and one of those involves how terrorists are recruited.
Well, our research shows that most people who become recruits for terrorism in the Islamic world are people who believe that Islam is under threat, that somehow West's ascendancy basically means that the Islamic world is going to lose whatever independence or independence of belief it has. As long as people are believing that, That is what is really inspiring them to terrorism. So the other things, for example, that this is just about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that this is about poverty, that it is about lack of opportunities within the Muslim world, empirical research shows that that is not the case. Those may be secondary factors for why somebody becomes an Islamist terrorist, but the primary factor is these are people who really believe that their faith, their identity, and their tradition is under attack.
And so, again, if we look to the U.S. and some of the policies that the U.S. is implementing to try to fight terrorism, and obviously there are congressional hearings going on right now about the secret domestic spying program, it would seem that what you're saying is that these potential terrorists are very sophisticated and may be sort of different than what we're thinking in some of these policies.
These are not unsophisticated people sitting in caves, which is what the impression some people have, especially after 9/11. You actually had, comedians in the United States, comedy shows sort of about, you know, how could some guy sitting in a cave with a turban? Well, the turban is a symbolic thing. It's not that these people are unsophisticated. Several of them have been engineers. Several of them have had westernized education. It is their belief and their belief that the United States and its policies in the Muslim world pose a threat to Islamic identity. And it's a belief that they want to recreate the Islamic caliphate. They want to recreate Islam's ascendancy around the world. Some of them are even more extreme. They talk about restoring all those lands that were under Islamic rule at one time, which would mean even Spain and Sicily. They say that until that is done, we will continue our jihad. The presumption in the United States seems to be that as long as you go after the symptoms, which is as long as you can track those people who have already been identified as terrorists, you will be safe. I don't think that the people who have been identified as terrorists or potential terrorists or the ones who speak loudest against the United States are necessarily the threat. The one who is likely to conduct an attack is not likely to give himself away in a telephone conversation by speaking words that would actually make him more of a target.
Right. You also write about the ultra-conservative religious schools known as madrasas. Those are not really centers for potential terrorists.
Well, the point we are making is that they do spew hatred against the West. They do train people in hating Western lifestyles. But for one thing, their impact has been overestimated. For example, in Pakistan, which is one of the countries which was always considered a major center for Islamist terrorism, less than 1% of school-going age children go to madrasas. What happened immediately after 9/11 was the journalists arrived, they wanted something to write about, and there was a superficial sort of pointing of fingers at the madrasas, because it's very simple to see young people sitting there learning by rote, not learning anything modern, and being very anti-Western. But the truth is that most of the people who have actually conducted attacks, of them, very few have been madrasa educated, and there's a reason for it. To conduct an attack in a Western country, you need somebody who can speak the language. So somebody whose total learning is in Arabic or a native language somewhere in the provinces of a backward Muslim country is not suitable for that. There are people who need to have the technical skills, so therefore they should have some basic engineering or physics training and know something about chemicals to be able to put together an improvised explosive device. And madrasa students simply cannot do that.
Right. It sounds then we may not really have a profile of who might be a potential terrorist. Is that what you're saying? There's not sort of a clear profile, or is there?
I think that a simplistic profile is not what actually enables us to understand who may or may not conduct the next attack. What needs to be done is to create a more sophisticated profile. It would vary from country to country. It would vary from region to region. And yes, the people that have already been identified as being affiliated to extremist groups are not the only ones who are likely to be the next terrorist. Basically, what you're looking for are people who have a very strong sense that somehow Western ascendancy equals Islam's humiliation. These are people who think that the hereafter matters to them a lot more than the here and now. And these are people who have accepted some of the indoctrination of the Islamist extremist groups around the world.
Just finally, Professor, I'd like to ask you about the furor that's been going on over the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and what you think that may or may not do to further terrorism.
Well, it's very important that that feeds into the whole belief system that somehow our religion is under threat. And I think what needs to be done over time is to highlight the fact that Muslims in most Western societies have considerable freedom, in fact, all freedom, to practice their religion. That the political Islamist movements do not have a monopoly on piety, and that when they try to exploit things such as this particular instance, then the response should not be a knee-jerk response as, there you go again, you crazy backward Muslims, but actually to say, let's talk about it. Have we ever abridged your freedoms of religion? And since we haven't, don't consider us as anti-Islam. You have as much a right to be part of the modern world as we do. If you have grievances, those grievances need to be resolved through other means than violence. And I think it's time to understand that in this particular war, this is a different kind of war. In any other war, you can win just by military means. But the very nature of the war against terrorism requires a major effort on winning hearts and minds in the Muslim world. And I think the U.S. is just beginning to even focus on the problem rather than to move in the direction of finding solutions.
Hussein Haqqani is director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. He's also author of the book Pakistan, Between Mosque and Military. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR in
Here and Now. The Senate Energy Committee is beginning its review of President Bush's energy budget today. The president has called for cutting America's dependence on foreign oil over the next 20 years, but at the same time, he's proposing reductions in alternative energy programs. That has many states taking a new look at coal and technology that turns coal into a synthetic natural gas to run power plants or into liquid fuel. In Montana, there are vast untapped reserves of coal in the eastern part of the state, and Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer says that could help ease U.S. dependency on foreign oil. Governor Schweitzer joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hey, cowgirl, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
It's great to be with you this morning.
You have been advocating coal to liquid fuel plants, and that would use what's called a Fischer-Tropsch process to turn the coal into diesel or jet fuel. Why are you interested in this technology?
Well, I think the greatest challenge to our society today is our increasing dependence on foreign oil. And this oil is not coming from our best pals. When you look at the cast of characters where we're importing our oil, probably the best friend we've got is our good neighbors directly north of Montana, Alberta, which are huge energy producers. They're good friends, and they're great suppliers of energy for the United States. Well, you go south of the border, and you've got Mexico that over the course of the last 30, 40 years, sometimes friends, maybe sometimes not so friendly. Venezuela now saying, and they are a big exporter of oil to the U.S., now saying, no, we want to send all of our oil to China. We don't like the U.S. anymore. Okay, so let's go to a place where I used to live. I lived in Saudi Arabia for 6 years. For you Arabic speakers out there, Assalamu alaikum, mahab. Now 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Iraq, Iran, Libya, I also lived and worked there for a little while. Algeria, Angola, Nigeria, and a bunch of countries that end with Stan. Most of those countries have large populations of people who do not like us, do not like our culture, and a portion of that money that we're putting in their hands is landing in the hands of terrorists who we're fighting all over the world. The greatest challenge to the next generation in this country is what we do today in terms of making ourselves energy self-reliant. That's why I'm an advocate of great wind resources, biodiesel, solar, and yes, converting coal to clean energy, eliminating the mercury and the sulfur, sequestering carbon dioxide, and producing energy that will be the bridge to the next energy source. We will not use hydrocarbons 50 years from now in great abundance, but we need to build a bridge to get there. Some would advocate, well, there's enough foreign oil to get us through. Let's use foreign oil until we get to that next energy source. Is it hydrogen or something else? Well, I think that is an option. Surely we can continue to import oil, and then we'll go to natural gas, liquefied natural gas, from these coyotes and crooks and dictators from all over the world. We will continue to have to send our young people to defend those oil fields all over the world if that's your plan.
Well, let's start with the coal-to-liquid fuel plan. Right now, I understand you've been in talks with corporations who would support this proposal. How likely is it that something like this would become a reality, do you think?
Well, I think economics are the greatest part of it. As you know, the day before 9/11, we had $25 oil. And $25 oil will not support the technology that it takes to convert coal to diesel, gasoline, or aviation fuel. It just won't. $40 a barrel will. If there's somebody with a crystal ball out there that can tell us 100% for sure that during the course of the next 20 years, the price of oil will stay above $40 a barrel for much more than it's below $40 a barrel, that answers the first question that people need to invest in this technology. The second part of the answer to this is, what is the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense going to do relative to domestic security?
On the federal level, are you encouraged by President Bush's energy budget?
Well, I was encouraged by the rhetoric, but I'm discouraged by the budget. There's no there. When Kennedy announced that we're going to put a man on the moon in 10 years, he described all of the resources that the federal government would bring to bear as private and public partnerships. That's the way you get this job done. You don't get this job done by delivering a 45-minute speech and putting a broad brush across the wall as if there's a plan. There is no plan there. In order to get this going, you will need private-public partnerships in engineering and technology.
You mentioned sequestering carbon dioxide. That's obviously been a big concern, the environmental issues that might surround this kind of technology. How would you do that?
Well, I don't think I have to do anything new. Jimmy Carter, all the way back to the days he was president, he talked about coal gasification. In fact, there was a plant built in Beulah, North Dakota, that's been operating since 1984. They separate the carbon dioxide, pressurize it, and then pump it right back into the oil fields that are near Beulah, North Dakota. It sequesters the carbon dioxide. It increases the pressure in the oil-bearing rock, increases oil production. It's called enhanced oil recovery. The carbon dioxide is sequestered, and you increase oil production. That's the way we would do it. We've been doing it for decades, and we'll continue doing it in Montana.
Isn't that very expensive, though?
Actually, the oil companies pay for this carbon dioxide between $15 and $20 a ton. So it might be expensive, but it increases oil production, and the oil companies are more than happy to pay for that carbon dioxide.
I just want to mention the Northern Plains Resource Council, the group that represents farmers and ranchers in Montana, says that this proposed facility that you're mentioning would create thousands of pollutants every year and would use huge amounts of water. How would you deal with those concerns?
I would say that they have to do a little better research. In fact, they've used data that is not only outdated, but is incorrect. This process will eliminate 100% of the mercury and sulfur from the coal before it produces electricity, and it has the ability of sequestering the carbon dioxide and increasing oil production. So there are some people, when they hear the word coal, they say, oh, coal's dirty, and I agree. Coal has been dirty for the last 100 years. If somebody is proposing new plants in the way that we've been using technology for the last 100 years, I am not a supporter, not interested. But when we have these technologies that actually produce fuels that are cleaner than the fuels that are coming from oil today, hey, you got me interested.
Another issue has been a cost, and this proposal relies on the price of oil, which can't be guaranteed. So when you're in talks with some of the companies, some of the major companies who might be the developers of this kind of technology, how do you assure them that this is a wise investment?
I can't assure them of anything, but I think most of the energy people from around the world recognize that we have a diminishing resource and an increasing demand. With China and India emerging as huge energy consumers, there are plenty of oil companies around the world that are betting the price of oil is going to continue above $35 and $40 a barrel because they're buying those raw resources around the world for those kinds of prices. Coal liquefaction, you know, we've had that technology, as many of the listeners know, since 1923. The Germans used it in World War II. The South Africans have been using it for the last 40 years. And there's a plant being built in Pennsylvania right now. So we will be making a portion of our portfolio with coal to liquids like diesel and aviation fuel. Will it be 5% of our fuel demand or 50%? I can't say that. We'll know that. Stay tuned 20 years from now.
Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer talking with us about his plans to develop a plant that would turn coal into diesel or jet fuel. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we now want to take a closer look at some of the alternative uses for coal. There are two main technologies. One would turn coal into liquid fuel. The other converts coal into natural gas for power plants. For more on this and how clean these technologies might be, we're joined in studio by Kelly Sims Gallagher, the director of the Energy Technology Innovation Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And Kelly, it seems like Governor Schweitzer is all fired up, if you will, to develop a coal plant that would produce fuel in a process that's known as the Fischer-Tropsch process. Can you explain how that works?
You start by gasifying the coal, and then once you have the synthetic gas that is from that process, you convert that gas using what's called the Fischer-Tropsch process into a liquid fuel. Whether it's worth doing it depends on the price of oil, and right now the price of oil is very high, so people are saying that this is an economically viable option. If the price of oil falls, which is what the government predicts, the Energy Information Administration predicts we could be back to $30 a barrel by next year, it's not clear that this would be economical.
Mm-hmm. And when we hear these ideas, either coal to liquid or coal to gas, for some of us, they might sound very abstract.
Yes.
Out in the ether are they? Are they reality right now? Where do we stand?
Using coal gasification to generate electricity is still relatively uncommon, although we do have several demonstration plants around the world that actually do that. And even more uncommon is coal to liquid. That process is done in South Africa, Malaysia. They're trying to do it in China, and it looks like we're going to try and do it here in the United States.
Hmm. Let's move on to talk about coal gasification. Can you explain that process for us?
It's not very complicated. You gasify the coal by heating it up and adding steam. And then once you gasify the coal, you can sort of separate it out and create a synthetic gas, which is just like natural gas. And you can use coal gasification and hook that up to a power plant, like a natural gas power plant, and use a gas turbine and a steam turbine to generate your electricity. And you also get a pure stream of hydrogen, which is interesting because you might want to run a fuel cell from the hydrogen, using the hydrogen. And you get a stream of carbon dioxide, which is the greenhouse gas.
And what do you do with the carbon dioxide, which is obviously
the
issue?
That's the big question.
Right.
I would say the big downside to doing coal gasification or Fischer-Tropsch is that if you don't deal with that carbon dioxide, you're going to have a big increase in greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. What you can do is to capture that CO2 and store it in underground in a depleted oil or gas reservoir, and hope that it stays down there. And then you could really have zero emission. That's the goal, that's the dream, and that's behind the president's Future Gen initiative.
And that's being done now? Is it being done?
No, it's not being done anywhere in the world. And so we don't really know whether it works yet. But if we're shifting in that direction, we really need to try it out and see if that carbon storage is a viable option.
So we would have no idea what might happen if we did store it?
We don't have a lot of idea. We know that there's a lot of carbon dioxide that is underground, that just naturally is underground. But there have been explosions and eruptions of carbon dioxide in the past. I think the risks of that are pretty small. But all of this is still pretty unexplored territory. We need to just try it out more and learn from demonstration projects about how to do it safely and whether it will stay there without leaking.
So how far away is a facility like this, would you say, from becoming a reality?
Well, I think you can do the coal gasification now. Mm-hmm. The technology is proven, and we just haven't done it commercially anywhere in the world in terms of using the coal gasification to produce electricity. So the sort of unknown is it too expensive to do that at this time?
Well, thanks very much for being
sure.
with us. Kelly Sims Gallagher is the director of the Energy Technology Innovation Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. George, the troublesome but lovable monkey, makes his big screen debut tomorrow. The animated film, also called Curious George, features the voice of Will Ferrell as the man in the yellow hat. In this scene, he meets George in the jungle, and immediately they start making friends.
Hello? Anybody in there?
Peekaboo.
Peekaboo. Peekaboo.
A-boo. A-boo.
Well, look at that. A monkey who likes to play peekaboo.
The film will bring new life to the monkey whose adventures have charmed millions. But as author Louise Borden points out, the creators of Curious George led fascinating and sometimes perilous lives of their own. In fact, Curious George almost didn't make it to the page, and his authors almost didn't make it to America. Robin Young spoke with Louise Borden this fall about the couple behind Curious George, artist H.A. Ray and his wife Margaret. Margaret, by curious coincidence, lived on Robin Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, prior to her death. As Louise Borden writes in her book, The Journey That Saved Curious George, The True Wartime Escape of Margaret and H.A. Ray, the Rays, German Jews, carried the original manuscripts of what would become Curious George's story when they fled Paris by bicycle in June of 1940, just hours before Nazis marched on the city.
Everywhere there was confusion and noise, grinding gears of overheated cars, and the frightening drone of German scout planes. Constant and relentless were the car horns, honking to speed up the crawling procession of the largest motorized evacuation in history. More than 5 million people were on the roads of France that day. Among the sea of humanity were two small figures, Margaret and H.A. Ray.
Take us back to how these two people met. It's the story of this beloved character, Curious George, but it's also a love story between Margaret and H.A. Ray. They both grew up in Hamburg. Hans left first for Brazil, and then Margaret, who had been a student of the Bauhaus, left because Hitler was rising to power. And they find each other in Rio.
Yes, they found each other in Rio. Actually, Margaret's family knew Hans's family in Hamburg. They had met earlier. She was sliding down a banister, and that's the first time he laid eyes on her. Mm-hmm. So Margaret, when she left Germany after Hitler's rise to power, looked Hans up. She knew he was there. She admired his work, and they became very close, and they decided to get married there, and then they went to Europe on their honeymoon.
But do we read in your book that before they left Brazil, didn't they have monkeys?
They had pet marmosets, which are tiny little monkeys.
Yeah.
And Hans was quoted as saying that occasionally one of the marmosets would knock his glasses or go across it when he was working at his desk on his drawings.
So with their love of monkeys, but sadly without the monkeys, they return to Europe, to France. There the drumbeat begins of Germany encroaching on France. Did they understand the danger they were in?
I think they did understand the drumbeat. Both of their families were leaving Germany. But when they were in Paris from 1936 to 1940, they were enjoying life in France, and the war had not yet come to where they were living. Shortly after war was declared, they left Paris and traveled south to a chateau.
And in that chateau, Curious George was born, again with this drumbeat of the Nazis approaching in the background, but he originally was called Fifi.
Yes, he was called Fifi. Their first book for children was published by Gallimard in 1939. It was called Raffy and the Nine Monkeys. Raffy was a giraffe, and there were nine monkeys. The baby monkey's name was Fifi. So the Rays took Fifi as a character and began writing about him. Fifi was a little boy monkey who lived in the jungles of Africa. He was very curious. So they continued working on this text called Fifi. When they arrived in America and Houghton Mifflin decided to publish this manuscript, the U.S. publisher said that Fifi seemed a bit feminine for a name, a bit foreign, and so Fifi became George.
But before that, Fifi, because he at that time was Fifi, went on this incredible journey with the Rays as they fled Paris on bicycles, and the Fifi manuscript was one of the few things they took.
Yes, correct. And they were weaving in and out of traffic, surrounded by thousands of people on foot, in cars, in buses. The first town they passed through, Etampes, is about 25 miles south of Paris. And 2 days after the Rays passed through, that town was bombed and 400 people were killed.
They made their way down through Portugal to Rio, to France, but, you know, had to go through Spain and sleeping in people's houses. They were relying on the kindness of strangers, sleeping on hay.
Yes, yes. Now, no one has known this information, I don't think, the details of where they stayed each night and the experiences they were having, until I was reading through their Hans's pocket diaries. Every day, Hans recorded every franc he spent, the work he was working on professionally, and where they were going. And I matched these pocket calendars to events in history and also to some of the bills that they had, the visas they were issued when they were traveling within France and out of the country.
Quite a detective story as well. And you lay it all out in a book that's sort of a collage. You have illustrations from Alan Drummond, which are just exquisite, sort of the artist's, his conception of what the Rays were doing and where they were, alongside H.A. Ray's own illustrations, their letters, photographs of their diaries, as you said, and your text. It's a beautiful scrapbook. It's as if it were a scrapbook of their trip.
My task as the writer is to take some complex information and the backdrop of World War II and make it accessible to young readers. I see this as a book for, you know, fourth and fifth graders. Third graders could probably read the text, but they need the prior knowledge of geography and the war. And so with the help of teachers and librarians and parents, they could get that. But for me, the story wasn't there. I wanted to read this book, so I wrote it for myself, and I'm an adult. I'm 55 years old.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, this is a lot of work. You work very closely with Margaret Ray's estate, but what was your passion in getting to the bottom of the story?
All of my books come from a passion for a subject or an event, and until I have written about it, I haven't gotten rid of that passion. So when I learned about the Rays' flight from Paris, I read a snippet in Publishers Weekly in the winter of 1995. I said to myself, oh my gosh, how amazing. And they were on bicycles that Hans built. I did not know at that time that the Rays had been Jewish, that they had lived in Brazil. I really knew nothing about their early lives or that Margaret was a photographer.
Well, it's just a delightful read. It's also a relief to know that, you know, we now have Curious George instead of Curious Fifi,
yes.
Which might have happened. But could you settle one thing for us? The legend on my street was that this wonderfully impish woman, up until she was 91 when she died, I always understood that H.A. had created Curious George sort of after her. And when you saw her walking her dog down the street, you know, she had that sort of monkeyish, devilish air about her. Is that true?
I've heard that also. I never had the pleasure of meeting Margaret as you did. Certainly the Rays' art reflects their lives with boats and rivers, bicycles. Hans smokes a pipe. The man with the yellow hat smokes a pipe. And Margaret just had that sparkle and that twinkle in her eye and that unique energy. Everyone who knew her said she was a very singular person.
Yes.
And was her own self. Just as George is.
Louise Borden is the author of The Journey That Saved Curious George, The True Wartime Escape of Margaret and H.A. Ray. Curious George, the movie, opens in theaters tomorrow.
There's no stopping curiosity. I want to turn the whole thing upside down.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, here and now.
I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing and dance to Mother Nature's songs. I don't want this feeling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us.